You were talking about teaching both undergraduates and graduate students. Now, this interests me. Did you feel that there's a large difference in the two kinds of teaching?
Yes, there is a difference. And the difference, of course, is that the graduate student is already, or should be, has a fairly wide background already, has come with a certain competence, and should come with a certain competence in language, and is also specializing, and the kind of work one does in a graduate course is much more in-depth. And also, the graduate students participate in the seminar. I think one of the things that one has to do in a graduate seminar is to make sure that material is presented that is new to the student, who comes already with a certain preparation, and that the student begins to participate in the development of the seminar. And one, that is something which is more, which requires a rather different attitude, and also which is more demanding in the sense that the graduate can raise questions that you may not be prepared for. In other words, you are more vulnerable in a graduate sense, in my opinion, mm-hmm. because you don't come with your material ready. You do come with your material ready, but you don't know in what way it's going to be taken over, and in what direction the student may ask you to go. So you have to have considerable preparation in depth as well as in scope. Now, the undergraduate student comes with curiosity and much less knowledge. And out there, what you have to do is, what are we going to teach? What am I going to teach the undergraduate student? What are the important things? In other words, what you have to do is to select a certain number in the, you have a reading list, since I'm talking about literature, mm-hmm. not language. You have certain texts that you feel that if you're going to major in French, that the department feels the undergraduate should know. And when you begin to present and discuss those texts, you, at least I say to myself, before the hour is up, these are the points that have to come across. You have to build, and you have to give them a certain leeway, but you have to keep present in mind that they have to acquire certain knowledge and a certain method. In other words, what is relevant in the discussion, what is just going hitting wild, and yet give them a sense that they are seeing or discovering things themselves. Can you see the difference that I'm trying to make?
Yes, I can.
So that I think that the two require a different type of preparation, a different relation with the students, and certainly a different method of conducting, on the one hand, the SAM, of involving the student, and on the other hand, the class. It's a different involvement.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be much more, you have to be much tougher, much more demanding, I think, on the graduate student in the sense of precision, method, documentation. And you have to give the undergraduate a certain feeling of participation, which the graduate student already has, because he's specializing, or she, I should say,
mm-hmm.
more and more she specializes, and she is a specialist already. Whereas you have to give the undergraduate an entrance into the subject. And why is it why should he take any interest whatsoever in Madame Bovary? To me, it's a miracle that you that you teach wherever you teach. And if you go out into the middle, you know, what is extraordinary is to know the people out in Idaho, etc., are learning French and are reading Madame Bovary. Now, why, in heaven's name, should an American undergraduate student be interested in French literature? I don't start from the assumption that they should be interested in French literature and culture.
You don't?
No. I don't. I start from the assumption that I hope they're going to get a lot out of it, because I love it. But that we have to furnish the entrance into that field, and so that during the teaching hours, we are the ones that have to lead them into the understanding of what it is we're doing, with the hope that whatever we do in French literature is going to be helpful in English literature. Because I think teaching of literature is basically the same, except we have that great difficulty of the language barrier. Now, that language barrier is no longer so great in the graduate seminar. The graduate already has a competence in language and can perform in language. And this is one of the great difficulties of teaching undergraduate courses, because they so want to say so many things, and they're not equipped to say them.
Mm-hmm.
And where you make the balance, and that's why teaching literature classes in a foreign language is really difficult, because it's very hard to evaluate someone who has a very fine literary sense, but not a very good grasp of the language. How do you grade them?
Oh, I see. Yes, that would be.
See, how do you grade them? Now, if you grade them only on the language, then it's a shame. It's a pity, because what they grasp is something about the literature, and that is what you want them to get, of course. And you're constantly torn between saying, "Oh heavens! I mean, look at this French. It's all full of mistakes." And sensing that there is someone who has something to say about the text. And the great, of course, temptation is to go into English. And if you go into English, and some of my colleagues do, they say it's the only way we can get the undergraduate really interested in really expressing herself or himself. And there's part of that, but once you go into English, you're lost. You've lost you have lost the student for French.
By going into English, you mean reading it?
Read it in French, but the discussing and writing the papers in English.
Oh, I see. You read it in French, but...
But yes, they often discuss it, and I can understand, because one is perpetually frustrated by the fact that between you and the student for communication, you've got that language with which they are struggling, these students, you know. And it's coming out full of mistakes, and it's so discouraging for them. And they're saying... They don't know what they're saying, because they don't know what the syntax is or what the vocabulary is, the possibilities are. And so the professor has to struggle through paper after paper, trying to make out what they're really driving at. Because they're French, you can't learn a language well in, you know, after 2 years of elementary and intermediate French. You cannot learn the language so that you can actually think in it and say something personal in it. So that almost inevitably you translate from the English into words that have no, that it's very hard to interpret if you're a professor. And that's the great difficulty of the undergraduate teaching. So that is, but I love to do it. And I think undergraduates are always extraordinarily stimulating. I think you have to leave them a certain... I think the undergraduate teaching has to be more flexible. That one has to be understanding with regard to that language. Because it's one way of grading, which is a quick way, is to say so many mistakes, so many points off in language. But that is not that is that is that is selling the student short, who has struggled through the text and struggled to say something. And the more the student struggles to say something, the more mistakes that student is apt to make when the grasp of the language is not sufficient as yet, and it's certainly not going to be sufficient when they begin to do literature in the third year, if they've just done, you know, as I say, the four semesters of preparation in language. It's not going to be sufficient.
No, I can see that. Very well, wouldn't be.
No. Language learning is a long process.
Well, that's where it's so nice if a child has the opportunity to learn it very early.
Yes. And we don't do in America what we know we ought to do. And we all of us know it. That is to say, teach language in the early stages of school. They have begun to do that and then they stopped. But that is where they should be learning it.
Mm-hmm.
And then keeping it up, and it would spare a lot of anguish and dismay.
Well, I think Americans have been rather smug about this language, but they sort of assume everyone else should learn English. Why should we learn other languages?
Mm-hmm. Well, they come to it from a different angle, because the first problem for the Americans is indeed to Americanize a great many non-American groups. So that their first problem is to make them speak English so that they can communicate and so that they can find their place in society.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the difficulties of having a population that comes in, sometimes these people are not too literate in their own language. And if you get a person, as language studies have shown, if you get people who are illiterate in two languages, it's disaster. They will never really place themselves in the society. They will be marginal in all kinds of ways. So that I think that is why the Americans start off with this problem. But afterwards they do not, I think, quite see that language is a highly intellectual, the use of language is a highly intellectual exercise, and the passing from one language to another is a very demanding intellectual discipline.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what they think, you should not pick it up, you know. And they don't, often in the education establishment, they say, well, why can't they learn? Well, let's have a lot of machines. You know, mm-hmm. That was the great thing. You spent thousands of dollars in machines. And that's not the way language, it's a help, it exercises, gives them exercising, but language has to pass through the mind.
Mm-hmm.
But that is difficult to explain.
Well, of course, we haven't had, in another sense, we don't, our country is not surrounded with other countries with a lot of different languages. It seems to me that certainly Europeans expect to rub elbows with other languages, and they take it more as a natural thing.
Everybody, it's so small, you know, you travel across from France to Germany to Spain to Italy to England, you know. But I understand that here at the University of Wisconsin you teach something like 40 languages.
Is it that many?
I may be exaggerating, but I know you teach a great many languages.
That's true.
A great many. And that I think probably for very few students, and some of the least well-known languages. They have to be highly specialized then, I suppose.
Yes, I don't imagine there are many in some of these languages.
But I think that there's a really big effort made, but it's earlier that this should be done. I don't say 40 languages, but at least bilingualism should be established, because then the mechanisms of passing from one to another are established. And I think it's easier then to learn a third language if you have to.
That interests me. You've mentioned the mechanisms. Do you find this confusing,
different kinds of, you know, thinking in English and thinking in French.
Well, it's a curious process. And sometimes if one is either too absorbed in what one is saying, one can suddenly be stopped because words come in the other language. And since the syntax, the construction is not the same, you're stymied. You can't go on. And that's why to a certain extent, I always write out my lectures, not for my students, but a lecture that I'm giving officially.
A formal lecture.
I write it out because it could easily be that I would want to say something and suddenly find I'm unable to, and then it's like stuttering. And sometimes bilingual people do stutter, and I can see why. That is a difficulty, and if you're tired, it may be that suddenly the two languages sort of, you no longer know which way to go. Now, it has happened to me once that I started a lecture in English and ended it in French, and I hadn't realized it. I had read, an academic lecture on poetry. I had read a poem or part of a poem in French, and I just went on. But these are strange experiences when I suppose the two networks get get tangled. Otherwise, I think that you generally start off on one track and
keep going
on that track, so that the juggling between the two is not too demanding. And of course, if I'm plunged in an English-speaking situation, then of course it's English that comes naturally. But the writing is another matter.
How do you mean?
Well, there are times when it's very difficult for me to write rather than one language. I write in both, as you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, this book I wrote in French. Mm-hmm. Now, I was in America much of the time that I wrote this book. And there were times when it seemed to me that I couldn't go on writing in French, that it was too great an effort to keep going in French. But once you start, then it follows. I don't know if I make myself clear. It seems as if you get on a certain track. But there are times when you balk and you don't want to write in that language. Mm.
Would you have found it easier writing in French if you had been in France?
Yes, definitely. Much easier. Much easier. But I started, and I'm very glad I forced myself to. I think that's one of the reasons that I have been able to, as well or badly as I've done it, been able to keep my two languages going, is that I write in both. And that has also the dangers that one... they're very different, those two languages. Your sentences aren't structured the same way. Your thought doesn't follow the same patterns. And it's very easy to slip into awkward structures, or what we call anglicisms in French, and naturalization of vocabulary. I can take a French word and use it in an English sentence without realizing it. Or one of these Latin constructions that's so awful in English. They sound so pompous. So certain of the rhetorical patterns of French that come from the Latin sound horrible in English. They sound pompous, they sound pretentious, they sound stiff. If you move from English to French, then the English can sound, if you use the structure, they seem sloppy. The French syntax is very Latin and very rigorous in certain ways, and a lot of things you can't do, and many things you must do. Mm-hmm. And English has more flexibility. But it's awful when you run into, when you're writing and you run into these sentences and you think, my goodness, how could I have written this? So those are some of the things that can happen. Either you start to think in the wrong language and then you have all the trouble in the world to switch. Mm-hmm. Or you're thinking in a language and you're taking ways of using language that don't belong to that language.
So it's it has its complications.
It has its complications and it has its pleasures.
Now, have you tried to learn a third language with any?
Indeed, I had
to an extent.
I learned both German and Spanish, but I've worked so much in English and French only that my Spanish and my German are much in abeyance. I could do some reading, I couldn't speak anymore. And therefore, I understand why people forget languages. You do forget language, unless you use it constantly. Yes, you use those languages constantly. And that's why I'm very happy to have been able to keep up those two languages and not be using one to the exclusion of the other, as might happen. And to use them in the context of writing criticism and dealing with literature. And not just the everyday life, because for the everyday life there's no problem.
I wouldn't think so. No. Don't have to.
It's
such a command.
No. For everyday living the exchange is easy. But when I go to France for a day or two, I feel very awkward. And then picks up again. But it's the writing and possibly the teaching in one language or the other. I teach in French.
That was going to be my next question. Do you do most of your teaching in French?
I do most of my teaching in French, but I teach a course in English at Wake Forest, one course in English.
You teach it in English, but it's French literature?
It's French. Oh, so not always. I do an honors course, which is not only French, which can pass. For example, we do one, it's for undergraduates. We did one on myth, we do one on comedy. We do various texts that are in translation, but that are not necessarily French.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes I do an advanced course only in French literature and translation, like French theater.
In translation?
In translation, French, let's say French avant-garde theater. Precise and limited as that.
Which do you prefer to do, teach in French or to teach in English?
Well, the answer is, in a way, that to teach in English is more fun because the students, these undergraduate students, are so much more at ease and so much freer to express what they're thinking and to make the comparisons with what they know. I have a lot of students when I do the theatre, I'm going to do it when I go back, who are majoring in theatre, but not in the history of theatre, only actually in the theatre. They're going to be actors, they're going to be directors, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And that is enormous, enormously satisfactory, a lot of fun. But my job, my profession, is really to teach the others, and my heart, in a way, is in that other sector where I have fewer students, and where the struggle with the language means that my classes are much more reticent. They don't participate in the same way, and I know much less about them.
It makes more demands on you, doesn't it?
It makes more demands on me, and I'm never quite sure what I have or haven't got across to them. And this is always this language barrier, but we are, in departments of French literature, we are teaching French. We're not teaching only French literature. We have to prepare them to teach. They are going to have to teach too.
Mm-hmm.
Many of the undergraduates majoring in French are headed toward teaching either in the schools or, if there are any jobs, later in universities, but at least in the schools. And it's totally unfair not to not to keep this language thing in the forefront of our minds all the time. But it's more fun to teach in English.
I can see from what you said that it that it would be, because
communication is faster, is more spontaneous, and that makes a lot of difference in a class.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I've been told this, and I think it is true. Do you have any preference for teaching graduates or undergraduates?
No, I like to do both, and I do like this here. You see, I was for one quarter at the Ohio State University where I taught graduates, and I hadn't taught graduates. I don't teach graduates at Wake Forest, and I enjoy the undergraduates very much. But occasionally, I feel the need, as I taught at Ohio State University, to teach in a more in-depth way and more limited body of literature, as I feel about the NEH seminar in which I had my younger colleagues, you see, who are all PhDs, and this is more demanding. One can easily, with undergraduates, one can easily become, if one is not careful, almost a superb actor. And get away with, because we know so much more than they do. And can you see what I mean?
Oh yes, I think so. I've
not
suggested before that the teaching was acting in a way.
It is acting in a way, and one can become a kind of personality, which I don't like the cult of personality.
Well, some teachers definitely are, bad.
Yes, but most, you have a personality, but you don't play it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, I think, the temptation is to be a kind of superior God, you know, quote,
mm-hmm.
to the undergraduate. And this is not bad, perhaps, because, you know, it engages their interest. On the other hand, I think it's a very good thing to be brought up short with a group that is demanding, much more demanding from every point of view, and to have to be really deeply prepared in depth. I mean, not deeply prepared in depth on a more limited topic where you. And you have to think things afresh and think things new. I think you have to think things new all the time. Otherwise you get so boring. But you have to think things new, but that's not the same kind of thinking. So I like one of my difficulties about the graduate teaching is the practical question of, will these graduate students get jobs? Are you preparing people for non-careers? It's not exactly our responsibility, it's theirs, but just the same. When I was doing my teaching here, there were jobs. There was no problem. Our PhDs got jobs, and they were very good PhDs. They deserved the job. Now they're good, they're very good PhDs, I'm sure, and they deserve the jobs. The jobs aren't there.
Well, this is true in other fields, too, it isn't. Yes.
And so that, you know, that gives you a little feeling of dismay when you look at them. You think, here they are, they're well prepared, they're brilliant, they love the stuff, they want to teach it, and then what are they going to have offered them?
Mm-hmm. Well, you seem to be echoing what I've heard in other areas. This is one of the sad facts at the moment.
It's one of the sad facts. And I don't think it's. I don't think it's necessarily going to be a short-term thing. I've seen other cycles go, but I think this one is going to be a long-term one, as far as I can see.
What makes you feel that way?
Well, the calculations they make about the population, though all the predictions from cycle to cycle have been false on the whole. So much longer. So, well, you know, they make the calculation of what the student population will be, what is going to happen to the humanities. The saving grace would be if they could get interested in language for us, I mean, again, which I think they should, but it's not likely. The President Carter's Commission on Foreign Languages.
I think you said last time that 7 years of being an administrator in New York was enough. Is that
yes,
why you decided to come to Wisconsin?
Yes. Well, in part, I was very fond of New York and New York University, but as I said before, it was extremely exhausting from every point of view. Now, I was young, younger, and the offer came from Wisconsin. I had been to Wisconsin to give a lecture, and it had never occurred to me at all that such an offer would be forthcoming. And I had very good friends here, Julian Harris, for example.
In the
French department. And Bill Bandy. And particularly, I think, probably Julian Harris and Betty Harris. So then, when the offer came, I had to make a really important decision. But it was such a marvelous offer. The Institute was just starting. I'm the second, I think, permanent member that was nominated. Marshall Claggett was the director.
Mm-hmm.
And the, of course, the great advantage for me was the fact that I would have no administration. I was going to be teaching two courses, I think, then. They then cut it down to one when I began to have a lot of students whose dissertations I had to direct. I think that's how it went. Perhaps it was only from the beginning one course. I can't remember. But the situation at the Institute is so exceptional from every point of view. That is, I didn't quite know it at the time I accepted, but I did know that it meant a much, much quieter way of living and many, many more hours for research. Now, the stipulations of the Violet Professorship are excellent. There is, for example, there was in the endowment a quite sizable sum of money for getting books. The library, of course, was better than the NYU library. And one says, of course, we could use the New York libraries, but if you want to use libraries outside, your own library in New York, it's always a big hassle. You have to travel, you have to meet all that traffic, and it's always a waste of time. So the situation for me was exceptional. I was interviewed by people who then became friends of mine, and they were very strong on the humanities, which of course is my field, mm-hmm. in the specialized form of contemporary literature. And the whole atmosphere, there is no red tape in this institute. There's a minimum of red tape. We have only a very few actual committee meetings, which is mostly to choose the fellows. And no very little interference of any kind from duties which had been so strenuous for me in NYU, since I was a member of the administration as head of a rather large department. And then the beauty of the place is so great, it's such an attractive place, that it was, for me, definitive. And I took some time in turning in my decision, because it was so hard for me to get out of the NYU. I had to see the president and to explain this to him, and I could never get to seeing him for a while. And then, of course, there was the general argument, why do you want to leave, etc., etc. But I'm very glad the day that I made the decision and sent the telegram, I consider it to have been one of the best days in my career. The next years that I was at Madison, Wisconsin, the 13 years, were absolutely marvelous years from the point of view of what I was able to do as research. What I was able to do, too, in traveling, because the situation here is such that if you want to, you can leave for a semester, which I did when I went to teach in Australia, but that was the summer. So I actually didn't have any teaching to do in the summer here.
Mm-hmm.
And then the semester I spent at the University of London and the University of Cairo. Of course, the Australian, as I say, didn't impinge on my presence on the campus, since it was their winter is our summer. Mm-hmm. And those were great opportunities. And then there was the students. This was a period of time when we had the most really excellent group of students I had ever had in the graduate school. The undergraduates were very interesting. The undergraduates, there was a big undergraduate population.
Oh yes.
And then, as I say, the very pleasant atmosphere of the institute, with the privileges involved, and the kind of relation with the director and with the executive secretary, Loretta Freiling. And she just makes life so simple for us. All these things were for me very, very positive.
So it was a good decision.
Oh, I think it was a marvelous decision. I was able to do a lot of writing, a lot of reading, and make a lot of contacts too. I had time to think. And also, from the point of view of health, there is no comparison. I had already said that when I came to Wisconsin, it would mean an extra 20 years to my life. The strenuousness of life in New York is real. It's great.
I can imagine. I have never lived there, and I don't really want to.
No. You have to travel, first of all, to work and travel back, and then the constant impact of the noise. The life is complicated in New York.
I can imagine it must be. You said you had very few meetings here at the Institute, except for choosing fellows. How is that done? And how many?
Actually, we occasionally had meetings that were presentations of work of the senior members whom we chose. How do we choose the fellows? There are several kinds of fellows. The senior professor, the Johnson professor, actually, I think the way we did it was to suggest possible names of Johnson professors, and the idea was that you got a professor, a senior professor. Mostly we got them at the time I was there from abroad, from England, from France, from Germany, from, I think we had one from Denmark. And generally they, I think, came by contact and invitation. The junior fellows that come from outside apply. And we have all the list of them. The files are at our disposal. We go through the files and we go through the usual process of ranking them, and then sitting around the table and calling our rank, what we've ranked them. And first, if there were, let's say that we only have room, I think, for two and possibly occasionally three, so that generally if everybody is in agreement on a couple or then, or let's say four or five, then that is a very simple process. Mm-hmm. If there are very divergent views, then that's different. And if someone feels that there is an utterly brilliant candidate that wasn't picked up, then we would discuss we discussed them all.
Mm-hmm.
At the time I was here, we went through the whole file. But if the opening consensus is very, very strong, that is unanimous, it means the discussions are much shortened.
Yes, I can see that.
Right. Since we're in very different fields. Now, what helps, and helps a lot, is that what we tried to do was to get the kind of fellows from our side who specialized somewhat in the same field as our senior fellow, so that this would make a group of people interested in the same topic or virtually the same field, and it would be a great benefit for the younger people and more interesting for the senior fellow.
I see. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And then another thing we do is to very often meet for lunch. We have what they call the brown bag lunch downstairs in the library. And this is a very cheerful, relaxed meeting where we, you know, chat according to what comes up. Sometimes the topic that comes up is a topic that has to do with our work. Sometimes it's a more general topic of university interest. Sometimes we're just chatting, mm-hmm. humanly chatting. Mm-hmm. It's a very, very fine formula they had here. Very relaxed, and I think the man who set the tone was Marshall Claret. From the very beginning,
he founded it.
Yes, and then there was Julius Weinberg, who was also in philosophy here, who was the third, I think, permanent member, and who was also extraordinarily open and human, and always would make his particular knowledge, and he was very widely read. He was very erudite. Available to any of us, if we had, let's say, an allusion in a text that touched upon something that obviously came out of medieval philosophy. I had one in a Beckett text I was doing, and I went to him and I said, "Look, Julius, what is this? Where did it come from?" Because Samuel Beckett is did quite. Serious studies in philosophy, in medieval philosophy, at Trinity College. They're very good there, and he found it, where the illusion came from. There was an exchange. It was very interesting. We had a very fine senior fellow from Cambridge, England, who was interested in modern French poetry. And we met all of the members and discussed certain texts, certain poems. They're very difficult poems. And Julius and Marshall, and I don't think Marshall was there then, but Julius and anybody else who was there, Emmett Bennett, for example, people who knew French.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very, very exciting. And so that this is the kind of thing, the exchange that goes on, completely unstructured. No one's obliged to have a brown bag lunch.
But it sounds like a very pleasant occasion.
It's a very pleasant occasion. And we're not so many, you see.
How many are there?
It depends on how many. I don't know now how many. You know who knows? It's Loretta.
Yes.
But I don't know how many there are now. In my time, we were sometimes 10 or 12 in the Institute, I think. Not with the people from outside. And as you know, we have junior fellows from the departments who apply. The people, it's a very sensible arrangement. Now, these younger men have projects. They want to work. But, you know, if they have to move their families out to England or something, they have all the worries of traveling, of finding a school for the children, whereas if they can come up here, their work is here, they have the library here, they can get the books they want in interlibrary loan if they're not in the library, without all this uprooting and time
mm-hmm.
that goes by, which is it takes time to move with two little children or something like that, and for the whole family to get adapted to a completely different environment. And so very often we have two, or I think that we always have at least two people from the university who are here. And perhaps one senior one, but Loretta will tell you. I think we have one senior one. At least we had in my time, because I remember Bill Bandy, who was specialist in Baudelaire poetry, etc., was up here at the time when we had our visitor from Cambridge, who was interested in modern French poetry.
That sounds like a very nice group.
It's a very, very, very nice group. We had a wonderful time when we had a medievalist, Venava, Professor Venava, and who was very genial kind of scholar, and was working in things that interested me, for example. Not only did I like him very much, and I had met him before, but he was working in forms, narrative structures. And narrative structures is one of the areas of research today, what they call narratology, how a story is told, what are the elements in the story, how you develop the plot so that it makes sense to the reader,
mm-hmm.
and that kind of thing, and what it conveys to the reader, how it conveys it to the reader. So we had some very good times in those 13 years.
Do these do fellows come when they come from other places? Do they come just for 1 year?
They can come for one semester.
Or a semester.
Yes, but they come for 1 year, mostly, one academic year. And I don't know if they stay, some of them I think stay over the summer, but I'm not sure. That again you will have to ask Loretta as to what exactly the rules are.
Well, now when you come, you're just here for the summer. Have you been here
yes.
other summers?
I was here 2 summers ago for the same thing. But I was a permanent member, violas professor, and emeritus, when I was asked by the National Endowments for the Humanities to think of developing this CERN, I asked here whether they would consider having me directed from here for all kinds of reasons. One, the climate. Two, the library. Three, the support that you get from the community. The Women's Research Center is tremendously attractive to these young women who take my CERN. As I said, we did have 2 young men, a few male applications, not so many. 2 very good ones I took. They had all the credentials. But it's immensely attractive to these young women because there are so many brilliant women at the University of Wisconsin that have taken responsibility for this research center in philosophy, in biology, in medicine, in law. And the distinction of the center, the Women's Research Center, is very well established in the country. So the support is extremely positive. And some of these young women who are completely isolated where they are so happy with this contact and these opportunities that it seemed to me that it has really shown that this was the place where it should take place. That there is no other, I think, university in this country that can do for those students, they're not students, those participants, those young women, mm-hmm. what this particular university can do for them. So I was very happy when they said, certainly, I'm emeritus. They would see that I had an office, and Loretta would do the secretarial work for me. And so here I came back. Since I have so many friends, it simplified my life tremendously, you know, for getting a place to live and that kind of thing, and for knowing how to get around the city.
Oh, yes.
And then I have all the privileges of the emeritus professor. I have parking facilities and...
Well, that's really something.
That's really something in this place. I much appreciate it.
Parking can be a big hassle.
Right. I found that out when I was at the Ohio State University, when I didn't have these privileges. I had a faculty permit, but this didn't mean that I had a space.
Oh.
Well, that's right.
If you could find one, you had one.
Hmm?
If you could find one, you had one.
If I could find one in certain areas, mm-hmm. I had it. But you know, it was not so easy to find most of the time.
Well, I can appreciate that. I mean, my own struggles at times.
I'm sure.
I'm glad to hear you say that the what you did about the Women's Research Center, about its success.
It's the center, as you know, was founded, when was it? Not so long ago.
No, it was really recently.
And I think what it did was to bring a remarkable team of women there. Not just, I've seen others, and I won't say where they have these very enthusiastic younger women, but who do not fit into the university research activity the way these do. And of course I have some particular interest and partiality, because the young woman, she seems young to me, though she is in her 50s, Elaine, she's just turning 50, but to me she always, Elaine Marks, I had her as a freshman in my class at Bryn Mawr College.
Oh, did she?
Yeah, she eventually did her PhD with me.
Yes, she wrote an article about you for the book that the...
That's right. Very nice article.
Put out.
And so I've known her for a long time, and she is, in her own field of French literature, she is certainly one of the high-ranking scholars, and she keeps writing. And she keeps writing, she keeps working at the academic at the same time. And I think that's absolutely essential. I think that women's studies have to have this kind of meshing in with the university activities, and they have to be academically very solid. And not just kind of inspirational. And that whatever the women's claims to the attention of the academic world, and I think they are valid, and that I think a certain number of things had to be said and had to be looked at. They have. This doesn't mean that because you're a woman, you're necessarily someone who's going to have to be respected in your scholarly field if you haven't done the work. I mean, it's not sufficient to be a woman.
As such.
But if you are, then you should be. And I think that that is what the drive has been here. And the people that one finds in that center are brilliant in many, many fields, outstanding women. And it's so good to meet them. And they speak so much sense.
Do you have anyone particular in mind?
Well, besides Elaine Marks, she has a wonderful team, and I wouldn't want to mention special people, but Professor Plyer and Claudia Card, and people that I wouldn't know so much because they may be in biology.
Mm-hmm. Other areas.
Yes, and younger women. And then there were people like Kravitz and Susan, her husband works for Friedman, that I've met, and that are all publishing in their fields. Diana Kavitch and Susan Friedman, who I think among the founders of this.
Mm. Yes, I think so.
And they are among people. And then you find people who are of different origins, of different ethnic groups. You see people who are American Indian, you see people who are Indian, you see, and the center really draws, and any woman on the faculty will find very good friends. And what I have been most struck by is that if there are rivalries, and I'm sure they are, they get thrashed out in committee meetings. But they don't carry over, it seems to me, to the personal. The affection and friendship is very, very evident there, too.
That's nice. Yes, there are bound to be problems, I'm sure.
There are bound to be problems. Among the first that I saw, two women who are not here, and but who are very, very brilliant. I forget Evie's name, Evie. And Susan, who is now teaching at Georgetown, but again, they were very brilliant in their field. One was a specialist in German literature, and I think Kafka. And the other was just Susan Lanser finishing her PhD with a brilliant thesis that was taken up by Princeton University Press. These are the younger women who teach there. So that altogether, I think they've done a wonderful job in that center. I think they can be proud. I think the university can be proud of it, and the women can be proud of it.
Well, that's a good thing. One of the, as long as we're on this subject, one of the things I was going to ask you about was what you just touched on a little, how you have felt as a woman academic.
Well, my career was a particularly special one in that I have not felt at all imposed upon. Perhaps a little when I was at Bryn Mawr and I hadn't as yet established myself in the scholarly field. And in France, I would not have found it easy at that time to get work in a university. There were almost no women at all, and the women who were there generally had strong connections with universities, one university or another in France. They're all, of course, state, as you know. They were very, very few. So I wouldn't have had probably had a university career. If I did, I would have had to struggle a lot more. But I came to Bryn Mawr, which was a women's college. And surely Bryn Mawr did not discriminate against women. It had some male faculty. And my superiors were women. The president was a woman. And the chairman of the department was a woman, who was a very fine woman. And my students were women. And sometimes I got bored with that. And I would go up to New York. And but they gave me my start. And I did, you see, I was promoted from lecturer to full professor at Bryn Mawr.
Oh, you were.
Now, had I come to a university, a large university, I would probably have felt the pressures much, much more. And I probably would not have been promoted that way. I did all the steps. And they didn't go fast in those days. Mm-hmm. But you knew where you stood. I mean, you knew that if you did certain things and produced certain work, you were promoted. So that I had a very good position. And then, you see, I came at that particular moment when I came back from my 2 years in the French army, where there was a need of people. They needed people. And there were not enough male candidates. They were still, some of them, serving in Washington or elsewhere. So then that's where I got my next invitation. I have never applied for a job, ever. Got my next invitation, which was at that particular moment, in the early 50s. And then Wisconsin, offered me this job, and my last job, of course, came when they had Wake Forest had these Keenan professorships, and I was very close to retirement. They had invited me to lecture to their honors groups. I knew the place, I knew what it was they were trying to do, and I knew what the situation was here. In other words, I knew that there was going to be a crisis for graduate students. I also knew that however affectionate they disposed they were, and heavens knows that they were always kindness itself to me here, they can't keep me beyond the age of 70.
That's
and I knew that I would get no other offer after a certain age. except for semesters. And I don't want to be an itinerant professor. I'd like to be nicely
settled
somewhere. So that's how my career developed. And I can only say that it seemed to me I was highly privileged. I worked hard.
Well, yes.
That's the point. You know, I didn't waste any time, I think. One always wastes the little time one has to. But I really worked very hard in those productive years of one's life when one is full of energy. And I found that I was treated very fairly. In fact, I found that I was really quite privileged. And in part it's due to the fact I can speak English.
That certainly must have
that helps
been a big help
for someone who's foreign. And you have to know in what context you are. I think sometimes younger people don't really grasp the context in which the university works. Now, that one can be, I think, one can protest if you don't think that the decisions are going the right way, or you think the attitudes are wrong. But one should know in what context we are working, both financially and ideologically, so that one should know what it is one, if one does.